Hello, you're listening to Spoiler.
Build.
Film.
Conversation.
Hooray!
Woo! Yay!
Woo! So, it's that time again. Podcast recording time for us, podcast listening time for you, dear listener. I'm Richard Nicholas, hello. With me is Anthony Evans.
Hello.
And Jamie Thomas.
G'day.
Mate. Are you trying to be connecting to the film?
Well, it's a New Zealand film, but
so apologise and then say goodbye, hello, as you normally would.
I'm sorry. Hello. I'm keeping my cork hat on though.
Do stop.
I don't care. It's Australia.
Don't wear
it's the same thing. It's the same place.
Keep your racism. Keep a lid on it, Jamie. We don't need to. This the reason we're doing a New Zealand film is we want to broaden our horizons.
Okay.
Anyway, we're doing a New Zealand film this week. A New Zealand film? That's not a genre. But we are doing a film that was made in New Zealand this week. It was Anthony's choice, so he will tell you all about it.
That I will. Well, as you say, it's a New Zealand film, The Quiet Earth from 1985. It's an apocalyptic sci-fi film, which is directed by Geoffrey Murphy, as he's called in this, but he usually goes by just Jeff Murphy in all the other things I've seen, who was a pretty highly influential filmmaker in New Zealand during the 70s and 80s. So the film stars Bruno Lawrence, Alison Routledge, and Pete Smith as survivors of some kind of cataclysmic disaster as they try to make sense of their new world and fend for themselves. The film was written by Bill Baer, Sam Pillsbury, and its star Bruno Lawrence, based on the novel of the same name by Craig Harrison. And the film is also thought to be very heavily influenced by another film from 1959 from America called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil.
Ooh. Mm. I like the title of this film, The Quiet Earth, because it tells you what it's going to be about. It's about one guy dealing with a very quiet planet and, you know... I like a film title that does what it says. It's not metaphorical. It might be metaphorical. There might be deeper layers, but you can get it straight away. What's it about? Earth is quiet. Why is that? All the people have gone, except one. Or is it two? Or is it three? That's the gist, though, isn't it?
Good summary.
I thought Anthony's was very full of tidbits as well, wasn't it? It was like, oh, also based on this film with a weird name. Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I tried to try.
What was that? That film?
It was called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil.
It was a prequel to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
I've never heard of it.
Should you have?
I don't think so. It's kind of. I think it's a semi-B sci-fi movie from the 50s. So maybe not.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting one. I like the look of it from the trailer. I'll say my expectations up front. I was expecting it to be just a little bit intriguing and I expected a bit of a B-movie, actually, because it felt like, oh, it's going to build to some high drama. Hmm. But it seemed like an intriguing premise that I was willing to explore, this notion of a man dealing with the absence of all the other people. That was a good hook for me. So I was looking forward to it, but I'd never... The only New Zealand stuff I've seen is modern comedy, because they've had a little bit of a comedy boom in recent years, mainly through Flight of the Conchords and the people who are on it. But New Zealand, you know, they got a fairly decent comedy scene.
Have you not seen Peter Jackson's early films, like Bad Taste or
I haven't seen those. Braindead. I've only seen his big stuff. Yeah, well, the one about the small men with hairy feet and... a penchant for walking around for rings or whatever.
Can't remember what
Funny you bring that up, actually, because the director of this movie was also a second unit director on the Lord of the Rings film.
I think if you had something to do with films and you live in New Zealand, you're going to have worked on it, aren't you?
Yeah, I
don't want to focus on Lord of the Rings, because people, like, always in reference to the film industry or, you know, New Zealand and what it's about culturally, it always gets name dropped, and we did it very naturally, but I don't want to harp on about that. We watched this because we were interested in New Zealand cinema, and Anthony, why did you suggest it? What were you expecting before you'd seen it?
Well, I think I was expecting kind of the same kind of vibe that you were, like, a slightly more B-movie kind of thing. It looked, I don't want to say cheap, but for a sci-fi film, they're generally a bit more like expensive and lavish. And this looked a bit more kind of, like you say, B-movie-esque. So I suppose I was expecting something like that. But having seen a lot of New Zealand films, especially from the 80s recently, they're always a little bit different and quirky and their own kind of style.
They've definitely got their own form of... They've got their own sense of humour. It's like a little bit like the British and a little bit like Australia. Like there's being that little island on the side of a big country that gets all the fame... They've got a very unique perspective on life that comes through in their comedy, at least.
And, yes, you're quite right.
Quirky.
And I'd seen a few things. I wanted to choose something this week, just something from New Zealand to kind of show it off. And this one really stood out because there was nothing else quite like it. Like, there was a lot of drama and there's a lot of comedy, as you say, but this was really the kind of only kind of sci-fi genre thing that I found, and I found it quite intriguing as well.
Well, it's one of those sci-fis that does the crafty thing of being, you know, science fiction, but luckily the concept means we just film everything on the planet Earth as it is. We don't have to have spaceships and be in space or do weird stuff. The sci-fi is very much in the science that explains it, and the fact that there's a phenomenon that's happened. It's like it's something that couldn't happen. And is weird and has science fiction in it, but it actually is all set on Earth, just in a slightly weird way where it's empty. So it's a very sly sci-fi. It's a good way to do it on a budget, if that's the case. Though, you know, they had some money to spend. There were some explosions and stunts and buzzes in the background.
Yeah.
Well, that could have been us.
Well, like generally, it was pretty low-key, I suppose. For a sci-fi film, it had some very interesting visuals at some points.
It did.
But other than that, it was pretty low key, and it did kind of conform to this kind of just New Zealand filmmaking. It kind of fits in well with that.
Yeah, Australians, they do post-apocalyptic weirdness. They got big beefy vehicles, and they make Mad Max and go insane. And New Zealand are like, what if you were just alone? You'd just wander about around doing weird stuff, wouldn't you? It's a very different approach to an apocalypse.
I was going to say, I think that's kind of why I liked it so much, because you just kind of watch it, and you're like, what would I do? Yeah. And then he does stuff, and you're like, yeah, I'd probably do that too.
You do spend a lot of the film umming and ahhing over possibilities if you're in that scenario. Jamie, what were you expecting when The Quiet Earth was suggested?
I had actually heard of it before. I think I'd watched a trailer at some point, and I'd actually read the Wikipedia page just out of curiosity.
Spoilers.
I don't care. I always ruin films for myself.
That's what we do as a podcast, is just explain and talk about films that people may or may not have seen.
I can't remember why I looked it up or how I found it, but I thought it sounded like an interesting take on the post-apocalypse. And I just pretty much got what I was expecting. I knew it was fairly low budget. And I knew it was the first sci-fi film that New Zealand ever produced. I was expecting something a little bit idiosyncratic and strange, and I was expecting it to raise a lot of questions and not answer them, and it pretty much did that. It gave sort of cursory explanations just to provide it with a framework, but it didn't delve into huge amounts of just made up pseudoscience.
It didn't really care about answers. It cared more about the human condition.
It was more about the situation, and I liked that it was a rapture situation. It wasn't, you know, the apocalypse and nukes went off and wiped everyone out. I liked that it was strange that everyone was just gone.
Survival on Earth, but in a very different way.
Yeah, and I liked that element of the only people who survived were people at the point of death.
It's a little bit like, what if you're playing a zombie game, but none of the zombies have loaded, so you just wander around going, oh, that's weird. yeah, so it's a compelling concept, I think. We all seem to be thinking it was a good, interesting film idea. And now that we've all watched it, we've lived out the film with this main guy, who I guess is a middle-aged scientist, or at least works in a laboratory or on as part of a bigger science conglomerate jobby. But he's essentially a scientist who has woken up naked. Interesting choice, director. Throw some front above. It was above nudity as well, from above the bed. This bald naked guy. But yeah, we're thrown into this situation where he wakes up and slowly discovers, where are all the people at? There aren't any people here. Has there been an emergency? Have we all been evacuated? Seriously, guys, where are you? You know, we start finding out with him there aren't any people in at least his town and in Greater New Zealand. So it's pretty weird situation. But what do we make of the main guy we follow at first? What was his name, actually?
His name was Zach.
And we don't know why he survives at first, but he's just figuring out for himself, you know, that there aren't any other people on Earth for some reason this morning. What do we make of Zach?
Right at the beginning, we're not really supposed to think that much of him, if you know what I mean. He's meant to be essentially us, like an avatar for like the audience.
Yeah, kind of.
I think right at the beginning, it doesn't really give away too much about him because, you know, he's just kind of searching around. Although he does stay relatively calm.
Well, he's going through his morning routine, isn't he?
That's true. And like he doesn't easily panic considering the situation that he's in.
Yeah, he's rash, at least to begin with, because it's about him. He's just him figuring out that, oh, look, there's cars that are just off the road with no one in, and a lack of people. And it just builds on the suspicious level, doesn't it? Where you kind of go, like, at what point would we twig? And he starts to realise that there's literally no one in any place. Like, he's at a garage, isn't he? And he can't find anyone initially in a gas station. And he's even checking in the toilet, and there's signs of life, but no actual life anywhere. And then he finally kind of starts putting two and two together. I think he breaks into someone's house and, you know, fight, because he thinks he hears someone in there, and it's just appliances that are still going.
But I like the standing at the door, I think he was like knocking, and then he smashed the window in, and then sort of poked his head through the hole and went, hello? Pretty polite, like, oh, sorry about your window.
Well, this is his character, isn't it? Like you said, he's kind of unflappable, even when faced with like the harsh reality, but then also the playground of his environment.
Yeah,
he deals with it in a fairly reasonable and rash way.
I suppose, from the beginning, you could argue that he's more of a solitary person anyway.
Yeah.
So, perhaps he may at first kind of see this as slightly more of a blessing than anything else.
He does act like it at first. Like he sends out the broadcast to let people know he's there, but he also moves into a mansion and helps himself to whatever he finds. And I liked the walking down the street with a saxophone.
In a cop's hat and sunglasses, but just wandering the streets.
I did get the impression that he was generally a pretty solitary person because he didn't act like he'd lost anyone specifically.
Yeah, and also, if we consider his situation, the reason why, or at least the reason it gives to some extent, that he survived when everyone else has disappeared is because he had tried to commit suicide. And it's sort of, you know, he took a lot of pills and he presumably had either, maybe he, I mean, we'll get to the bigger picture at the end, but essentially, he'd presumably committed suicide or nearly committed suicide, and everyone else vanished at this moment in time, but because he wasn't fully alive, he is left there. And then when we see other people, the same story is, they all have the same story. They had momentarily died or had a near-death experience at this key time, and they didn't vanish like everyone else.
Yeah.
And so that means he must be like a depressed person and having a tough time. They don't elaborate on his prehistory very much, other than he worked for this science company that is something to do with why people have vanished.
Yeah, and yeah, he already thought, like, the reason he tried to kill himself was because he knew the massive risks of what they were trying to do. And he basically decided he was tuning out, like...
He was letting them do it, and he felt culpable and guilty of not doing enough to stop them.
But it was interesting that, like, it never goes into quite that much detail about what they were working on. It was something to do with the... Was it something to do with, like, an energy grid to have, like, some kind of renewable power source that didn't...
Yeah, and it also had connections to the military or something?
Yeah, and then he said that the Americans were doing something else with it they weren't telling people about. And then that just never gets explained.
Do you have a better understanding of it, Anthony? Do you remember more of what the grid was about?
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. I don't know if it was meant to be in outer space or anything like that, but it was some kind of like energy grid powered by the Earth itself, or maybe by the sun, which it will essentially become then kind of just the renewable energy of the Earth.
It was like
which will just keep everything running.
Yeah, it's made more interesting by not going into it in any more detail, because it lets you just try, like, think about it and try and figure it out.
You can't pull apart the science because they don't give you enough of it. Yeah, so the goal of the film, I feel, most of the time, is to go, okay, look, there's an impossible sci-fi thing going on. For some bizarre reason, an energy grid thing that we're not going to explain, randomly decided to take everyone who exists away, except three people, at least in New Zealand, and it just did it. It was the sun or something, and it's going to happen again, so don't think everyone's going to live happily ever after, just three of them. That's the idea. We don't know why.
I think it's by not focusing too much on kind of the whys, it makes you focus more on the kind of the theme of how do I put this? Kind of like when they first like made nuclear weapons kind of thing, how these people are all kind of coming together and bringing all their minds together for something of which essentially could be for mass destruction.
Yeah.
And how you kind of deal with that.
You have to kind of take into account the context of when, like, the film was made in the middle of the 80s, when that Cold War fear of, like, nuclear death was still everywhere. Like,
Armageddon was on people's minds in culture, definitely.
Yeah, and this came out around the same time as films like Threads and The Day After and all those kind of like, and the Mad Max movies, all those like apocalyptic films. But this does kind of take its own strange spin on it.
Yeah, and it's also about people dealing with solitude and loneliness. Even if you're a loner or a bit of an outsider, having no human connection, I mean, it'll drive you mad, and that's kind of the point. And also, you know, if you take something away and then bring it back, it'll draw you even closer to the people that are left. And it's kind of about people socializing and reacting to severe, like, kind of unimaginable loneliness and a kind of surreal form of, like, everyone. Like, you never, you know, we're never going to wake up one day unless it's all been one weird dream and find the world is empty. You know what I mean? But it deals with issues of loneliness and how we deal with people, and it should have you thinking about society and connections with people and things.
Yeah.
So it's trying to say some stuff, but it's also trying to entertain you by having this small, like, he's got a bit of hair, but he's balding, and he's a regular looking Joe, and he mostly wears a suit, wandering around in an empty city, where there's like crashed planes and crashed cars and a lot of stuff starting to look like a lot of stuff's on fire because there's no one there to do anything about it, you know. But it's still essentially just an empty city that he has to wander through or drive through, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting visual a lot of the time. Like when he finds the crashed plane and there's no people on it, and it looks great, like in like a junkyard that's on fire or whatever is going on. Did you guys like that element of it, the kind of visuals it went for with the emptiness and stuff?
Yeah, the whole kind of first, well, what was it, 15 or 20 minutes is all pretty much just Zack wandering around and not really saying anything and just kind of taking it all in, just like we are.
Yeah.
And you're right. That particular scene, the one where he's kind of rummaging around the wreckage, looks really, really good considering it's a fairly cheaply made film.
Yeah, and they try and create an eeriness that is kind of like is normally reserved for horror, but because there isn't an actual threat anywhere, the only danger is him to himself or something falling down or catching fire. Like there isn't, it feels like the sort of film that should have zombies in, but it doesn't.
Yeah,
and it's not about that. It's about trying to puzzle out what's going on and seeing if there's anything you could do. And like he's essentially has to figure out what's gone on. He goes to his work and he discovers essentially the accident and figures out the source of what he thinks could have happened. And then also with this plane scene, he finds a crashed airline plane and he can see that all the seats have the seatbelts done up, but there's no people in it. And it's just it becomes obvious that just for some reason everyone's disappeared.
Yeah, I like that. I like that rapture imagery that people have just been taken in the middle of stuff.
Yeah, actually, mentioning the rapture then, because it is kind of something to talk about, is the whole film could be explained in a kind of Life on Mars kind of way, if anyone's seen that TV show. I'm going to spoil the TV show now, so... essentially, the theory being that all of this was just limbo, you know? Like, one guy alone in his country, in his town, is actually just him trapped in limbo or purgatory, and this is a bizarre in-between punishment. He hasn't ascended to heaven, and he hasn't been sent to hell. He's left in this ambiguous place, which could represent limbo or purgatory or something.
That's the way I thought it was going to go when it revealed that they had all been, they'd all died. And I kind of rolled my eyes and thought, oh,
yeah.
Well, it's one of those... But
they're all actually dead, and this is some either hell or some holding place.
But then it didn't go in that direction, which I thought was it kept me interested. The fact that it didn't, which that kind of twist wasn't really to the point of being a cliche yet in the mid 80s. It is now. That's the twist in everything now.
They're all dead.
Something slightly weird's happening. They're dead. The whole time they've been dead. That's every film now. The Avengers. Oh, how are there superheroes everywhere? How are all these powers? They're actually all dead or in a coma, and they're all dreaming.
It's Lost, but, or it's Life on Mars, or it's anything. Yeah.
But this was before that became a thing, so I thought it was interesting that it subverts it before it's even a cliche.
Do you think so? Because what I took, right, is the end reveal is quite mysterious, because essentially our main character dies either again or dies. And then he's the very, very end now, he appears again, but on a beach. And he's still got his recorder for, taking notes, and a dictaphone or whatever. And but then also, he's at the ocean, he's staring, and there's these weird cloud patterns, and, this cloud pattern that it even looks like maybe Saturn is outlined or something. And it kind of ends on this weird, ambiguous... So he died in an explosion, but then he's on a beach, and it's as if he's back to square one again, but different.
It almost... seems to be that every time he dies, whatever the effect, as he calls it, of whatever the experiment was, has made it so that every time he dies, the whole universe just shifts and everything changes around him. So, because there's that scene where he puts the shotgun in his mouth,
yeah,
and that because up until that point he's been completely alone.
Hmm.
He dies at the beginning of the film, and then he's the last person left on Earth. And then he puts the shotgun in his mouth, and then the petrol station or something that he drove out of explodes right at the moment where, for a second, you think it was a gunshot.
Right.
And then he's, looking at this blown-up petrol station. And then after that point is where people start turning up.
Yeah, but also for me, it was he had gone crazy by then. And we will talk about that, because some of the most intriguing stuff is his descent into madness.
Yeah.
But he's reached the pinnacle of his madness, and he's going to kill himself because he can't deal with being alone, or presumably. And then I took it to be that he was distracted and realised, you know, he could die anyway. And like, but he kind of gets his stuff together. He starts wearing a suit again. He starts living a bit more normally and surviving and using his computer to work out what the problem is. So he becomes sensible and proactive again at that point. So it could be like a starting again, like a hit restart, because it kind of is like the beginning again where he's just dealing with it and in a suit. He shaves, I think, whereas he's been wandering around with a shotgun in negligee, rich woman's negligee with a shotgun. Slip. Yeah, it's just a really sexy slip that's slowly becoming like the vest in Die Hard, just worn out and tired. And yeah, it's really interesting. And then you think that's a kind of another reset point where he, you know, maybe metaphorically at least has died again or something.
Yeah.
Well, it could be. Well, that's what I think this film is doing, has done really well, has just, it's remained so kind of ambiguous that any of these could be true and we could easily find justification for all of them.
Hmm. Well, Anthony, how did you read it overall? Is this a guy who went to limbo? Is it a guy who literally everyone disappeared and then he saved the two other remaining people in a sacrifice and then when he died he went somewhere else? Like, what do you think it happened? What do you, you know, how do you take it?
Well, I honestly have no idea, because there are at first I just took it as the sci-fi concept that it was, just what they were saying, that's what happened. You know what I mean? Like some weird science shit happened and, you know, the world ended essentially. But they kept, definitely at points there were definitely clues. And they kept bringing in other elements. There was definitely a religious element going on, like being in purgatory.
Hmm.
Especially when you kind of like, it reveals that both he and I think it was the other guy, Alpi, is that his name? Anyone?
Appy.
They both both die in a kind of regretful way.
Hmm. Yeah.
Like he commits suicide and the other guy is murdered and he kind of feels responsible.
Hmm.
So there's the kind of purgatory thing going on there. But then the woman doesn't fit into that quite as much, because she was just electrocuted, it seems, and she doesn't appear to have any kind of regrets.
Hmm.
So, but then by the end, I mean, the spectacular ending, who knows? Is the universe collapsing in on itself? Or is it a parallel dimension?
That's how I like to read it, is that whatever experiment they were doing or whatever they were trying to do has now just, like, irreparably damaged the fabric of the universe, and it keeps sort of resetting itself.
Like and it's a kind of glitching video game or something.
Yeah, and it's going through these, like, possible versions of itself before it just collapses.
Well, this is the thing. It could be any number of things. There's a literal reading where you just go, the man sacrificed himself, and then he woke up somewhere. We don't know what that is. We can't say. It's a weird... It's a universe where it looks like Earth, but it has weird stuff in the sky. Like, or there's any number of things. I thought Limbo and Purgatory was being suggested by the filmmakers a bit, but they were obviously being deliberately, we are ambiguous. Like, you know, they were trying to be a little bit more pretentious or clever or whatever you want to call it, and let you decide what was that about. I don't think it was that much of a cop-out of an ending. Like, it could be what does that mean? I don't know what that was about.
It's the ending has the potential, or had the potential, to just be a really cheap, like, look, more weird stuff. But because the film is like manages to do a good job of keeping the concept intriguing, when that happens at the end, I think it has the desired effect of just making you go, what this now? What?
Especially as things have really kind of built up to that moment, and you're, I suppose you're kind of expecting some sort of answer,
resolution,
and then it just gives you, and then it just gives you that, and it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And yeah, I like that even he, like Zach's response is to like stare at it, and then he pulls out his recorder as if he's going to say something, and he just kind of goes, "Nah, I can't. Like, I can't even deal. I don't know how to
process." Yeah, what do I say? It's like in the film The Core, it's slightly different. He has his recorder, and then he's talking to himself on the recorder and realises he's going to die and the thing will die with him, and it was utterly pointless to record. So, you know, there's something brilliant about sci-fis that have people talking to themselves and recording their voice and realizing the paradoxes that that will, you know, if you're the only survivor, who's going to listen, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think we feel how he feels. Like, he's reacting like we are. Like, what? It's almost setting it up for a sequel. Like,
I actually thought that, you know, yeah, when it ended.
The noisy Earth, where he, this time, he goes and there's more people than ever, and they all crowd the beach around him after, like, this scene unfolds. No, but, you know, it kind of feels like it's setting up a sequel, or a potential for the second part of his journey, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So it's properly weird, and properly... And there's lots of unanswered questions, but it's all, you know, it's there's still a lot of intriguing bits to it that I think I want to go back and talk about and highlight, because, you know, we haven't even talked about the two other main characters and, you know, the kind of relationship. It becomes a kind of romance midway through. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I like that it does become a romance and then a love triangle, but between three people who obviously in any other situation would not be interested in each other. So there's this sort of awkward, well, I guess, to it. Like,
yeah, the film is definitely like a film of two halves. Like,
yeah.
the first is just isolation.
Hmm.
And then the second half introduces both of the other characters. And then the most conflict, I suppose, comes when, like, you have more humans. Even though there's still only three of them in the whole world, there's still that kind of conflict between them.
Yeah, it only takes two, maybe three, to have conflict. In fairness, two was going on fine. When you add a third person, everyone has, you know, options and more things going on, and complexity brings, you know, danger and problems.
Yeah, that's true, actually. One person would be horrible. Two people seemed actually quite kind of fun.
Yeah.
And then, like, three people just screws the whole thing up altogether.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, it's really enjoyable just watching one guy unfold. One of the things I really enjoyed was seeing this guy start to embrace the fact that, well, we'd all like to have the Earth abandoned for, like, maybe a weekend. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, we'd love to have the world as your playground with no one stopping you do whatever. You can take whatever you want, eat whatever you want, go. You can go in everywhere you've never been allowed. You can take everything you've always wanted. You can sleep and voyeuristically look around anywhere. But then there's the reality of, you know, with no one existing, you know, all the regular services, there's no hospitals that have any staff. There's equipment that's breaking. Electricity will eventually go out, and it does for our main character. And once you go full feral, you know, not Will Ferrell, full, you know, literal feral, you will become feral.
Although it close enough.
Scary. Yeah.
Yeah.
He does go a bit. As he becomes more feral, he becomes more like Will Ferrell. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. But I smell a remake.
Yeah. I think that there is a British... no, sorry. There's an American sitcom about... the guy who plays MacGruber is, like, alone on Earth or something. I think there's, like, a sitcom about that. So that's not a million miles away. I have to watch that. I can't remember what it's called.
Is it really? I've never heard of that.
It's something about a post-apocalyptic world with just this guy who's alone or something. I can't remember.
It's The Quiet Earth, but with a laugh track.
Yeah.
I have to say, I've seen, like, a few other kind of Laugh Man on Earth kind of things. And they all kind of, you know, tie back to this one in some way.
Hmm.
Like, I don't know if any of you guys seen the zombie film 28 Days Later, but essentially the start of that is, like, exactly the start of this film.
That's, I was going to say that a bit later on, that it reminded me a lot of 28 Days Later. I would even say the second half is kind of similar, because he finds more people and then it becomes about people reconnecting with each other. I mean, the difference, you know, there's an obvious difference with, like, that one is, well, it is zombies, but people say it's not. And it has, like, the military threat and stuff.
Hmm.
But this goes in a stranger direction than 28 Days Later.
It's just bolder to be less about big drama and more about, you know, intrigue and human conflict. Like, literally three people and a puzzle. That's all there is. Is yeah. We have to solve something, and the only the only danger is our man Zach thinks that there's the thing that happened and disappeared everyone may happen again, and they have to stop it. That's the only thing they have to deal with, other than their own relationship together when they all start.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really the whole film is really more about kind of like the human condition,
yeah,
and what that kind of means. Like, is just one soul human kind of floating in the world? Is that really kind of living?
Yeah,
if you know what I mean. And then they kind of it strikes a balance when there's like one male and one female kind of thing. And then the more you add, the more conflict there is, and the more volatile the whole thing becomes. So then it becomes these three people are just like a microcosm then of the whole world that's led up to where they are now, kind of thing.
Well, and just the film, the first half, I kind of find myself drawn to more because it gets you thinking, because you have less answers and less things to think about. You're just thinking about what would it be like to be this guy. He starts to, you know, put together that he puts like a radio broadcast out saying, are there other people, come to this address, which is a bit weird, come to my house, like, or phone me, I'll always be in, even though I've got the whole world to explore. But he basically puts this message out. Even when he moves house, he changes the message to, like, he realizes he can live in a big mansion. And I like all the what's he gonna do? And he takes vans to the mall and fills up his thing with full of TVs and like stuff from the mall and like a big emu. He just finds crap everywhere and he gets things he wants and he puts and then when the lights go out, actually it's a point where he's going. He's reaching a kind of pinnacle of indulgence where he's like drinking champagne in this mansion and doing whatever he wants, but not knowing what to do also. And then he kind of reaches a point where he's like got all these cardboard cutouts and mannequins on a lawn, and he's on the balcony pretending he's like the leader. Like, he basically decides, well, I'm the ruler of the world. I don't know where he got all of these cutouts of like Hitler and celebrities. Yeah. I don't know if New Zealand has cutout shops everywhere.
Especially of Hitler. I mean, when would you ever want a cardboard cutout of Hitler?
Maybe like a bookshop was promoting Mein Kampf again in the 80s.
Oh, we've got all these copies of Mein Kampf.
We've got to flog them.
They didn't sell too well after about 1946. So.
Yeah, but he's like he's starting to go a bit mad with loneliness, but also he's started to enjoy. Well, I may as well have all the pleasures I've always wanted, and wander the city as I please, and accept that I'm the only person. Therefore, I'm in charge.
But I like that that ends up being hollow.
Yeah, and then the power goes out, and you go, yeah. So there isn't anyone to do anything about this. You've lost power, but he's resourceful initially. He's got backup generators. He gets hold of them anyway, and he's got vehicles. He becomes more competent. He's got that kind of early Mad Max thing of coping with the environment and like having a kit that you take with you when you drive somewhere. You've got a van full of stuff that you're going to need nowhere if you go. He's getting used to this new way of living. And it's so intriguing watching it play out. And then the next step then is to introduce one more person. And I think that's the right move. And it's a woman and she just turns up in his life. Actually, we have to talk about the best thing about it, which is him fully cracking, going mad, deciding I'm going to wear a lady's lingerie. And then he gets to the point where he's like screaming in the church and taking the... What's he got? Like the Jesus model of Jesus on a cross. Taking the hostage and claiming, like just shouting at God that he's going to kill his son and stuff.
Yeah, like show up or I'll shoot the kid.
Yeah,
I actually thought that was pretty. That was a pretty heavy scene that came out of nowhere. I thought that actually says quite a lot about what the film is saying. That he's in this church and he's shouting out like, "Where are you?" And you don't know if he's talking about like people or if he's talking about God or
all of that stuff. And
yeah,
yeah, and you know he's starting to really lose it. But in a way, you kind of go, "Yes, of course you'd be like this." You know,
you would
be running around in lingerie with a shotgun, going, "What is happening to me? What I'm like on this insane punishment? What kind of God would let this happen?" Like, you know. And then he shoots the figure of Christ up in this church, and like we get a montage. We establish that he's dirtier and more feral than ever, and it, like Anthony mentioned already, he gets to a point where he's getting ready to take his life. I think he's like steals this massive truck and knocks over like a pram that has no baby in because there's no people, and it kind of makes him sad and like.
Yeah, I like that as well. I like that moment of he ran over the pram and he was like, "Oh no!" Like that instinctive. Oh my god! I just killed a baby, and then he goes and looks in it and realizes, "Oh, of course I didn't, because everyone's gone."
Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, it's a very filmic film thing, isn't it? That it kind of subverts with by doing that, like running over the baby carriage kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah.
But like I was starting to say, is it at the right time, it injects one more person. You kind of sensed it, not only from the trailer, but you kind of go, this is what the film needs, is there could easily be one more survivor, and that'll help with the mystery, because we'll have two accounts of what happened to us, and they can start working out why they survived or what is going on. And it gives him hope, and, you know, it's a good thing to have happened. It's after he started to pull himself together a bit. She just turns up in his current house, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And it's just like, they just look at each other, and, like, I just knew they were going to hug, because that's what, this just you just need human contact.
Yeah. Mm. After that long, what else would you do?
It's just, we must, like, you kind of, I liked the fact that they didn't just instantly, like, make love or something. It wasn't that. It was. They took a few days to establish a relationship and to be like they're still strangers to each other. They understand. They learn each other and where they're from and their story. But it takes them a little bit of time. But it wouldn't take long. You're the only people left alive.
Yeah.
There's no one else to judge you. You're going to just start a relationship.
Plus, there's also the kind of thing of well. It doesn't really matter whether I like you or not. We're the only two people left.
Yeah.
There's nothing else we can really do apart from be together.
And it's not a sense of duty. It's not like we must repopulate the Earth. It's we're humans. This is the saddest thing that could ever happen. Let's share in that. And, you know, let's share our... And they become like a couple, sort of. And they're both insecure about being separate because they're so frightened of being alone again. So they have radio communication, walkie-talkies or whatever. And they explore the city together and separately. But they also have a kind of cutie kind of relationship where she'll occasionally joke with him. So there's one point where they're in like a... She wakes him up with like a... Like it's like a hotel or something. And she comes on the intercom and says he has to check out. And then it's like revealed that she's not wearing any trousers but is wearing the top. Kind of, she's in that kind of a playful sexual... scenario. It's like she's having fun with him, but it's also that's how they establish that these guys are sleeping with each other now as well, and it becomes like a kind of weird relationship that's kind of cute, I think.
Yeah.
And then it's like it's the two of them, it's one man, one woman against, you know, what's left of New Zealand, and you know, they do some exploring, and it's kind of interesting how they the kind of way that unfolds. And it's not that long until we inject the third person, which is kind of the, you know, the big problem, I guess.
Yeah.
After the initial one of there's no people. Did you guys find it was odd that this third guy has been going around in an army military truck and has for some reason put on a balaclava, like he somehow needs to hide his identity from the no one else that there is in the world? Like, why is he going... Like, fair enough, he's kitted himself out in case, I don't know, maybe he still thinks it's a zombie apocalypse. But he's going around, he's got like a balaclava, he's like, what are you doing? There's no one else. Maybe you suspect there's someone else, but what are you keeping your identity for?
Yeah. I think it's just one of the many potential ways people could go, depending on the kind of people they are, if something like that happened. Like, there are, you know, there's doomsday preppers out there who've got their guns ready and they're waiting. Yeah. For something to go down, so they can go full, they can go full territorial army.
Yeah, and this guy is obviously savvy enough to suspect there's other people, and he doesn't know if they're going to be hostile. I guess he's a bit paranoid, so he sets up a kind of a trap, in of a sense. So he's laid out some cars so that you have to drive a certain way, and he basically confronts Zach by taking him like taking him hostage, like with a gun, and stopping him and confronting him without revealing his identity initially for some bizarre reason.
Yeah,
and it's very odd because, you know, it becomes a tension of is this guy alive, but he's psychotic and unfortunate. Well, unfortunately, it's not going to be, you know, a fun day. It's not going to be a fun experience. It's going to be a terrifying threat.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't go there. It doesn't say this guy's going to, you know, kidnap them and be part of the conspiracy. He's just a loner also. And they have that moment, I think, is it like he speaks on the radio and gives away that there's another person, even though the guy said there isn't anyone. And so they confront her, and it's going to be this potentially sad, tragic moment. And then, for some reason, it just goes, I guess we could all group hug now that I've took you hostage. What do you guys make of that?
The thing that stands out for me in that scene is the horrendous dress that she's wearing.
But that's funny. She, like, when she's out exploring, she puts on horrible clothes for a laugh.
Yeah, which, fair enough, again, is probably something you would do, but... Yeah. Oh.
Disappointed? Or...
Yeah, it's just a horrible 80s Cyndi Lauper sparkly, spiky dress. It was just... Oh, it was painful to look at.
Sure.
Oh, you know you'd be wearing it too, Jamie.
Oh, yeah.
Hattie, what did you make of the weird switch in, like this guy was going to be a psycho, and then he suddenly is friendly?
It does make sense. Because, like you said, it is kind of all about humanity, and, you know, these are still the only people he's ever met. And...
He's being cautious. You know,
it makes sense that they'd all embrace. And I suppose overall, even though there is some conflict between the three of them throughout like the last third of the film, it's not as much as it could have been.
No, it's mainly, you know, there's a little bit of, well, there's two men now, so there's options for coupling up, or, like, you know, if we're going to repopulate the Earth, there's options. And, you know, one actually, this guy... Is he like, he's like native New Zealand? He's like a black guy, but I think he's like...
Yeah, he's Maori.
Maori, yeah. So there's a sort of like, well, it's only fair if we repopulate the Earth that we don't let one race die out.
Yeah, it's not, yeah.
There's a kind, like, if you, they don't ever start discussing the ethics of, they only care about themselves initially. So it's mainly about having options now that there are three rather than being forced together.
Yeah.
And also different personalities, and then the potential to lie and talk to one person and not let the other one know. Whereas when with two, it's much simpler. It's what you say to the other person, what you keep to yourself. And then it's the triangle makes it all the more complicated socially. And this guy, you know, he took them, he had guns on them initially, and might have a different approach. But they band together, don't they, and essentially start dealing with the problem that is being outlined as that this might happen again and we might be vanished away or whatever.
Yeah.
So we've got weirdly camoed up military-ish new guy. We got regular woman who's got a bit of a penchant for putting on terrible dresses. And we have suit-wearing guy who has worn his own dresses occasionally but has serious-ed up a bit for the film. And they're together as this like dysfunctional threesome for a bit, aren't they?
Yes, they strike their own kind of balance together as a threesome. But then Zach has always kind of definitely been a separate entity of his own, because he's the one we've been kind of following from the beginning, and he's the one who seems to have. If anyone's got the answers, it's him.
Hmm. Because of his unique connection to the events, you know, he's linked to it. But then he's also, their jobs or their background is irrelevant to solving the problem, I guess, as well, isn't it?
That's true. Plus then they kind of, the other two then have a kind of attraction to each other. So that separates him a little bit more as well.
Yeah. Plus
which kind of comes back to the kind of... the theory where it could just all be in his own mind. And I think he brings that up at some point, telling them that they're both figments of his imagination.
I like the idea that that would come up with a regular person in this situation where they start doubting the reality that they're in because of how strange and stressful the situation is.
Yeah, in a way, they could be like... they could be like... In Castaway, they could be Wilson's to the Tom Hanks character. Like, has he just painted a beach football and is calling them different names? Do you know what I mean? Like, are they essentially a figment of his imagination because he's gone crazy? You know, and was the only person left in this weird situation. And then equally, could they be of crazy? It's kind of like, it's kind of a unanswerable philosophical worry that he brings up, isn't it? But essentially, they have to. They kind of, they, you know, they have to trust that he knows what he's talking about as well. That's, that could help create a rift a little bit because they're taking his word for it.
Yeah.
But he's not fully endangering them. He's making them do something and go near the factory that is currently dangerously radioactive or something.
It's it's the lab that that it all started in, and it's like at the beginning of the film he escapes because it's like massively radioactive because of whatever happened.
Plus, it locked him in briefly, and he had to kind of explode his way out.
Well, it was to keep the radiation contained. So I suppose when they finally go back there at the end, it's now in like the surrounding area, so they can't really get close.
Mm.
So I think it's he never says it, but I think it's a thing of like, if we all go in, then we're probably all going to die. So
yeah, we should consider what we do carefully.
And I like what happens. I like the fact that they start off, Zach and I can't remember the woman's name.
Joanne,
have this, they develop a romantic relationship, but it's like you were saying earlier, it's kind of out of necessity because there's no one else as far as they know. Mm. And I like that when Appy turns up after some sort of awkwardness, she starts to actually genuinely fall for Appy.
At least that's what they say. One of the things I didn't really buy into, because there were things I didn't like about it, and it was, I didn't fully, I think they rushed the third part or the last chapter. I felt like I didn't really buy into her suddenly switching allegiances and falling for him a bit. I mean, she might have found him attractive, but he's not exactly the most, he was quite a difficult person at times, and that part of the moral problem they had was he'd killed someone and he was being murdered. He was being at least someone was attempting to drown him when he survived, you know?
Yeah.
So he's like a slightly scary character for them a bit. So he's not the obvious like love interest to switch to. I'm not sure I fully bought that she would switch as much as they said, you know, it became a relationship that became muddied, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't when I bought into fully. I'm not sure.
It did seem to happen very quickly.
So that kind of happens because we're still with Zach. The audience are still with Zach. So as he doesn't get the kind of perspective of the other two, neither do we. So we kind of feel that kind of isolation he's starting to feel, where I think there's a point where he has a speech about, even though like he probably knows they're not talking about him or conspiring behind him, that's just how he feels.
Yeah.
And also, like, the race element comes into it, where I think the biggest challenge he gets from Appy is, oh, you're in charge now, are you? Because you know some stuff. And he's like, you know, this has race implications. We've lost the whole history of the world. We're not going to start that again where the white guy's in charge. Like, that's not going down that way. But also, he has to kind of realise that, you know, this guy's the scientist and maybe knows that there's a problem and how to deal with it.
Yeah.
So they have to kind of compromise and deal with it as a team and unite rather than bicker. But, you know, I think it's, you know, it's an interesting dilemma. I think, again, it becomes very filmic when essentially, okay, we need to get loads of dynamite and blow up the lab. And it's like, okay, you've become a big, silly movie now, whereas before you were being an intriguing, thinky piece. I think it still stays interesting. It doesn't become Hollywood and silly.
I like his... I did like that he's a scientist for the whole film and he understands what's happening and to a degree he understands. He has a lot of theories about what's happening and what caused it in the first place. And he has a like really in-depth knowledge of this technology and this effect. Hmm. So he's like, right, we need to stop it from happening again. Let's load a truck with explosives and drive in there and just blow it off.
Yeah, shut down the grid system that's presumably done something. With the explosions. Power source, or explosions or clock. Another thing, I guess, that makes it a real threat for the other two, because they don't know he's telling the truth necessarily, but there's also weird events that happen that are like small cosmic events where they start to trip a little bit and not be sure what's going on.
I was going to mention that. That is probably one of my favourite scenes in the film, because I was not in any way expecting it and had no idea what was happening. Like, they were mid-conversation, and then suddenly everything went mad, and Appy was climbing up a wall.
Yes, it starts to go like that scene in Inception, where he's, like, running, and then the wall is the end. Yeah.
And then suddenly everything goes back to normal, but they're all in different rooms.
Yeah, it's and almost like one of the video game glitches happened to them.
Yeah. That was crazy. That was cool. And it was cool that it didn't happen all the time. So when it happened, you were just sitting there thinking, what is what? You were as confused and displaced as they were.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings home that we're not all just, you know, happily marooned in the world of empty people.
There's some serious risk and strangeness happening here.
Yeah, we're not just free to be, the three people who now own the world. We have to deal with this. We don't know what's going on. And the challenges could be of any kind. Nothing is certain. Yeah, and so, we get this conclusion where essentially Zach kind of suggests they need to, like, use the truck by a remote control. I think they establish he had a lawnmower rigged to remote control. So they hint that to the audience that, maybe he's legitimately saying we should remote control a truck full of dynamite into the place or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But we get the feeling, it's kind of obvious if you're, like, film literate that, okay, he's probably lying and he's going to sacrifice himself. Like, I got the feeling that's where it was going. So he leaves the other two to say, I'll go back and get the thing I need. And then, presumably, he does donuts for 20 minutes so that they can have a scene where they make love really boringly in their control room or whatever. It was really this uncomfortable, weird...
Yeah, that was... scene. It was like, let's do this now. Like,
I'll just go all Barry White on you and suddenly we'll be having slightly dull intercourse.
Because... I see the, the one of the overarching themes of this is that Zach is this kind of inherently lonely person. And even when he's left as the last man on Earth, that then, like, he realizes how lonely he is, and then he finds someone, connects with them because they have no other choice, and then she finds someone else, and he's left by himself again.
He's almost back to his role of, well, I inherited the world, now I will go back to controlling it, and I'll decide the destiny and things. He doesn't let everyone decide. He decides, okay, I'm going to do this. Save them. Does... Be nobler, but also, it's a control issue as well.
But, like, the price is to have to be alone. That's the ending's pretty bleak as well, that he ends up where he ends up. Like, he doesn't even die. He just ends up isolated again.
Yeah, I don't know if it comes off in the film, but I guess what you're sort of implying is if these two do stay as a couple, which maybe, they don't fully say that, it could still be a bizarre three-way relationship of the only three people alive, but if it becomes these two couple up, and he's impossibly alone again, and he can't face it, so that could be an issue, he could just want to he might have fallen in love with her and want to do it so that she can survive, But for whatever reason, he drives the explodey truck into the radiation-filled factory dish thing, and bang, goes everything, and we have a weird, trippy bit, and then, whack, you're on the beach. Deal with that. What's going on? And that's what Anthony gave us with A Quiet Earth,
Yeah.
We've been trying to deal with it all this time.
Yeah.
I feel like it's the kind of film that kind of sticks with you for a while afterwards, because it's so ambiguous and kind of leaves... all those questions.
I certainly, the image of a balding man in negligee with a shotgun in a lavish house has stuck with me. It's quite the image. And it keeps you thinking, and also you can't really fully unravel the film. From what I read about on the wiki afterwards to sort of see if there was like something I missed about the ending, because it is a bit ambiguous, is the filmmakers were saying, well, we kind of meant it to be obvious. It is what it is, and it's sort of a bit like Limbo, perhaps. They weren't trying to be overly clever. They were just going, well, we've given you ambiguity, and that was deliberate. They weren't trying to say something, overly complicated that can be worked out. It's just, make of it what you will. And we've certainly been fairly positive towards it. You know, I'd only be critical of some elements. I enjoyed it mostly. What did you guys?
Yeah,
thumbs up or what?
Yeah, overall a thumbs up. I think you were right. Like, I think it loses a little something when the other two characters are introduced.
With complexity, it becomes less intriguing, perhaps.
I just feel like I enjoyed the first half of the film more, where it was just him, kind of just wandering around and doing stupid things. Like I like the point where he has a snooker match with himself.
Yeah, that was funny. Weird. I forgot about that.
There was another scene where he's playing with toy trains, and there's just a jump cut him in an actual train. And just like all the moments that stick out are from the first half of the film.
I agree entirely. Yeah,
I was going to say, I think that's because it's the more filmic aspect, because it's just one man, and he doesn't really have to say much, and he doesn't say much, and most of the stuff he says is just kind of theorizing, I suppose.
Yeah,
it's just much more filmic, and I think it's more powerful that way.
And also, like, it kind of switches gear. At the start, it's a film, and it's cinema, and it's compelling. And by the end, it's movie, and weird, and, you know, like, a little bit more, let's up the explosions and guns and cars, you know? And it's like, are you doing all right? I think we could have stuck with the kind of Twilight Zone thing. And like you say, there's so many bits, like the snooker playing where he's doing two different characters. Yeah. Actually, there's a comedian called Richard Herring who does a podcast of him playing snooker against himself in a kind of bizarre comedy meets avant-garde terrible experiment. And he does take on these two personalities and play snooker against himself, so it put me in mind of that. It was ahead of its time. It was way before Richard Herring even thought of the idea. I was pleased, though. Anyway, that's just by the by. It is a compelling first half, and like the second half with the new characters, some things I liked and some things I thought, you're not handling this right. I was okay.
Yeah,
it's
hard to find something wrong with the second half. It's just I preferred the first half.
It was a bit more rushed to get to a conclusion as well. The first half was discovery. Yeah. The second half is right. We got to end this.
Yeah, maybe.
We've got to develop these characters. Maybe in the book they had more time to deal with the nuances of relationships and social situations.
I think the book's pretty different from the film, from what I've seen, from what I've read.
All right. Yeah. I'm trying to speculate, really. But, you know, guys, final thoughts. Unless there's anything else you want to bring up, now's your chance. Did you mention the thing you wanted to, Anthony?
Yeah, it's just that I really enjoyed it. You know, it's visually interesting, and it keeps you thinking, and it kind of stays with you after it's finished, or at least for me anyway.
Yeah.
And just, we've said that it's just kind of ambiguous. So it's not just, here it is, there it is kind of thing.
It doesn't present you a moral answer. It just gives you some moral questions, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Jimmy, what about you?
So that's why I like it.
Yeah, I did. I enjoyed it. I think it's not perfect. It does have some faults. I thought, apart from the guy who plays Zach, Joanne and Appy didn't. The people playing them did not give the best performances. Joanne seemed to talk at a speed slightly beyond what humans are normally capable of.
I thought she was okay. I didn't have any problems. And
she wasn't terrible. She was just a bit... Everything she said was really fast and high-pitched. And Appy, I felt kind of... He was likable, but the performance was a little bit flat. I don't know if the guy had ever done any acting before or anything.
Yeah. I think they might have picked him for his bizarre...
He had a moustache.
Like, thick curly hair and a little... ponytail that at the back just horribly 80s.
Yeah. But he wasn't, like, none of them were terrible. It's just a bit, and I think it's probably just budget. They may have been first time actors, or they may have been inexperienced. But
plus, you've spent most of the film getting attached to Zach.
Yeah.
So I suppose you wouldn't get as attached to the other two because of that.
But yeah, the first chunk with him just by himself is really good, and it's a good exploration of that idea of like loneliness and isolation. I think the second half with the three characters would probably have been better had the film been longer, because it is unusually short. It's like 1 hour and 12 minutes. So if it had like had maybe a little bit more room to breathe, those relationships could have developed, because the way they went made sense, but they went too quickly.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. I think we're on the same page.
But I think the intrigue from the plot and from from the mystery of what happened, and the fact that it drops in little explanations, but it's not as if whoever, like the people who wrote it, had no idea and were just putting things in because it seemed like they had it mapped out in their head, but didn't want to tell the audience everything they thought of, so they just drop little bits in every now and again. And I think the reason the second half suffers is because there's a lot more interesting little quirks in the first half, and then it becomes a little bit more standard in the second half. But it still has moments like that surreal moment where the universe kind of turns upside down for a second. Yeah. I really liked that ending. I just liked the shot of this bizarre like alien landscape with the strange clouds. It's like they almost look like mushrooms or trees, and then the ringed planet rising in the distance, and Zach's look of just, where am I now? What is this?
What next? Yeah.
Yeah.
I've succeeded in one challenge. I thought this would be, mystery solved. Say, no, either heaven, hell, or the end. But now there's more, and I don't understand it.
Has he now eliminated the reality that he's from? Like, do Appy and Joanne just not exist anymore? And has he rearranged the universe by, it has all these questions and these potentials, but it's not. It does it without being cheap or frustrating or just being weird or mysterious just for the sake of it. Because it all carries this kind of like existential crisis about like isolation and being lonely and guilt as well.
Yeah, I think that's all true. What on earth happened? We don't know, but it was supposedly very quiet. So, guys, ratings, right? We're obliged to come up with a rating system. It's usually just some kind of awkward metaphor. I'm going to suggest things that are quiet. So I've got one as an example. A quiet thing that the film is like is it's like an intriguing, different kind of like crossword mind puzzle thing. You've come across like a little book to like you're waiting in a hospital waiting room or something, and you want to do a crossword, but they're kind of boring and conventional, and word searches are too easy. So you found a puzzle book, and it's got puzzles you've never seen before. But you start to unfold how they work and how to do them, and then you're kind of drawn in. And then after a while, you can't be bothered to finish because it's getting harder and stupider. And you think you've made some mistakes. And I don't know, it's kind of like an intriguing new, brain teaser puzzle that you've got enough clues to get on with, but you don't know how to fully appreciate. So that's how I'd say the film is. There's a point where you go, I'm starting to lose the interest I had when I was first killing the boredom, but now like there's a lot of you had fun learning a new way of thinking. Do you know what I mean? That's the kind of thing I'm thinking anyway. Have you guys got anything?
I've actually got one that's kind of similar to that. It's like I can't play chess, but I've had people explain similar like games of logic and strategy to me. As I'm like trying to learn to play them, I was just trying to think of something that's quiet. Chess is pretty quiet, so it's like sitting with someone who has played chess their whole life. They know exactly how to play it, and they're trying to teach you to do it, but they're doing it in like a learn by doing thing. So like they don't just explain everything to you in one go. They like start playing a game with you, and then as you go along, if you do something wrong or you do something right, they explain to you like why or how, and they drop in little bits about how the game is played without just giving it to you all at once. And then eventually you get the hang of it, and it then becomes like once you get the hang of it, you see the grid and the patterns and everything, and yeah. then it all like it kind of loses that intrigue towards the, once you've actually learned it.
Yeah, you still have to sit there moving horses and castles and going, why yeah. do I even care about getting across the board? Why don't we all just play, like, you know, Seven Wonders or something else?
And, like, just to tie it even more back into the film as well, no one plays chess anymore, so it's a very lonely game.
Yeah, it's a game that doesn't work with three people, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Maybe stick to two. It could have been an interesting rom-com, like, there's been some apocalyptic rom-coms that are, you know, mixed qualities. But it could have, like, I wouldn't have minded it becoming a bit about relationships if it had stayed as two people. Yeah. But, you know, whatever. Anthony?
I don't know. I can't think of anything offhand, but something based around the idea that, like the film, like when you... Like when you've had like a stressful day or something, or you've had like a stressful week and you think, you know what, tomorrow I'm just going to sit down in the quiet and do nothing and just be peaceful.
Surround myself
and
with
you do
dance.
That. And yeah. Yeah. And for the first hour, it's really nice. It's just peaceful. There's no noise and stuff like that. But then sooner or later, your mind has to work harder at stuff and then you get bored and then the noise and the quiet starts getting to you and you start to go a little bit crazy and then you kind of realise that, you know what, I need to speak to someone kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think of something around that.
It's like a quiet moment.
Yeah. It is kind of like, yeah, like a peaceful, quiet moment that you think you want, but really you don't.
Yeah, so you find yourself enjoying the quiet moment, but there are times where it goes a bit weird for you. Yeah, it is that, I suppose. Yeah, I think we've all come up with enough. I think that's enough to end the podcast on. We could leave it ambiguous if we wanted and just be like, I think it's like a lemon, because when life gives you lemons, yeah, lemons. Like, I don't know. When life gives you lemons, just... you know, put the lemons to the one side and play in your city of all the other things that you have available.
When the sun oscillates and gives you lemons.
Throw those lemons back into the sun. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's an okay... I mean, we've talked weirdly about lemons for no reason. I'm sorry for bringing lemons. They weren't relevant.
It happens.
Anyway... The Quiet Earth is one to check out. It's an intriguing New Zealand-y film from the 80s. And I'm glad they did it, because it was a weird watch. And I think I'll probably watch it in future as well. It's not one I've just watched once. I think I'll come back to it
I think you'll certainly have a new like edge to it, considering like watching it from the beginning, knowing that he's just kind of come out of like suicide.
Yeah.
I reckon you'd start seeing it in a slightly different way. So definitely one for repeat watching, I think.
It's an interesting one to read about as well, just to look up other people's interpretations. And
Yeah,
because I'm guessing like not everyone's going to have a different kind of opinion of what's going on in the film.
Yeah, for me, actually, the film it put me in mind of, one we've covered on Spoilerfield early on, I think before Jamie was doing them with us, is Phase 4, where a bunch of ants...
Yes.
come to Earth and mess around with humans and they don't know what... And then by the end you're like, what happened and why? You've asked more questions than you've answered. And I really liked it. And I think it was mixed opinions across the board for Phase 4. But it was just... I'll slide them both next to each other even though they alphabetically don't go. I mean, the little weird sci-fi area of intrigue.
No, definitely. I definitely had the same kind of vibes watching this that we did in Phase 4. Because they, you know, they look very similar, and they're both very kind of slow, quieter films about greater sci-fi. Not both greater sci-fi themes and themes of humanity as well. So and, yeah, definitely I see the connection.
Only there's more ants in Phase 4. You know,
yeah, a lot more ants.
But
although the ants might have survived in the Quiet Earth, you never know.
Yeah, we only ever got... The weird thing that we didn't talk about is occasionally they find corpses of people who died just before, and therefore they died, but no one could attend to them, so they would occasionally find these morbid scenes of car accidents and stuff. So there were no humans except dead ones to keep you company, which was kind of creepy. that we didn't really talk about. But I've mentioned it. That's that ticked off anyway. So, there we go, guys. I think that'll end the podcast anyway.
Yes.
We just meandered into a conversation about one we've already talked about, but whatever. Okay, time to go. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Bye.